This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Royal Grammar School Guildford, Dubai.
I'm Helen Farmer on today's episode of Eye on Education, kicking off with a big name from the world of parenting and potty training. Amanda Jenner was on hand to help out with those woes that so many parents face, from nighttime dryness to how do you know when they're really ready to drop the nappy. And in conversation with not one but two educators on pastoral care, what does it actually mean? What does it look like in schools in 2024? And what role do schools have on our children's emotional well-being?
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranches Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranches too.
So delighted to be joined live on Teams by Amanda Jenner. She is the potty training expert, the author, the creator of the Potty Training Academy and the My Carry Potty as well. And she is speaking to us ahead of appearing at the Baby Expo next weekend. How are you, Amanda?
I am good, and I'm counting down the days to get out of this cold UK and come to Dubai. It's raining as we speak.
I'd say careful what you wish for, love. It's getting a bit hot over here, but whenever my parents come over, it takes them a good day or two. They're like just to thaw out the bones from being cold in the UK for months on end. So the sun is shining and we're really excited to have you over. Now, you are going to be at the Baby Expo. Are you going to have any chance to meet with some families or have, I don't know, maybe have a chat with some stores about the My Carry Potty? What's on the agenda?
Yes, well, we've got lots of stuff going on. I really want to meet some parents. I'm doing some great talks at the show. So we're doing some mumpreneur talks. I'm doing some potty training talks. And I'm going to mingle with everybody. I'll be available for questions. So we're meeting lots of stores. We're currently in Mum Store in Dubai, which is a great store. And we're going to be meeting with lots of other stores as well. We've got lots of exciting meetings. So I can't wait to be part of the community and, you know, and serve the people in Dubai, basically.
Wow. We're picking your brains ahead of your arrival next week. So the text lines are open, as are the phone lines, 0487 15500, if you've got any questions for Amanda Jenner. And it might be questions about, you know, when to start potty training. It could be struggles you've got right now. Maybe you're getting ahead of yourself. Maybe you are at the absolute wit's end. Amanda, I need to understand about why you wanted to work in this space. What do we need to know about you to understand why you've dedicated your life and your work to parents and potties? Yes, exactly.
From inventing My Carry Potty, from when my son, who's now 27, was potty training, he used to take his potty with him everywhere, and I had nowhere to pour the contents. And when you're potty training, you have to empower the kids to go in and out the home. My Carry Potty was born. I invented, I don't know how I did it, but I was like, it's got to have a lid. We've got to make this, you know, not so challenging for parents. And then what happened was I started delving into it and thinking, why do children find it so difficult? Why do parents fear potty training? And then I realised why. It's quite tough. Mm-hmm. And it just went on from there, and people started contacting me. I started going to nursery schools. I started doing talks. I started working one-to-one with families. And then celebrities started contacting me. I've potty trained lots of celebrity children.
And it just went
on from there.
That must be fun to see them, see the little bottoms when they're tiny, to then being in the Daily Mail a few years later.
Yes, definitely.
Now, you've sold over a million of My Carry Potties now, and I have to say there are some very stylish numbers out there, so to speak. We're going to talk a little bit about the accessories and the kit and, you know, things that might be needed, but you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, after nearly two decades working in the parenting space, what changes or in challenges have you noticed? You know, do you feel like it's harder for parents now, or do you feel like because we've got more access to, you know, information, to experts, to bits of kit, that things are perhaps easier than they were 20 years ago?
Yeah, I'd say the kit obviously is, you know, way back in the days when people were potty training, it was a bucket, terry towel and nappies and pins. So that's changed in my space. But in the actual parenting space, which I work with as well, I think, yeah, there's definitely more innovative products that make parenting easier, 100%. I think things are more pressured on parents now because two parents are working rather than one. So that's been a really big change. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely more experts to hand, obviously, if you can afford them as well, because it costs money. There's definitely more help, I would say. Particularly in the UK, there's not so much more help with, you know, health visitors and stuff like we used to have. And there's definitely been a change since COVID with children perhaps not hitting their milestones as they should, because obviously we were all locked down for such a long time. Mm-hmm. I've definitely seen a big change over the last few years children changing.
Yeah, you're not the first to say that. I've heard from a number of educators and experts, everything from, you know, not being able to use knives and forks to socialization problem, behavioral problems in the classroom, potty training, obviously. Well, it's interesting. We've had a message that we're going to come to soon, which is, do you really need to stay at home for 5 days when you're potty training? Obviously, during lockdown, great time to try and crack it. Amanda, I really want to open up the conversation and I guess normalize some of the issues that parents listening today might be struggling with so we can help them. What are some of the most common challenges when you get a DM, when you get a message, when some things you're addressing in the book? What are the big pain points when it comes to potty training?
I think regression's a really big one, and children not wanting to poo is one of my biggest. How glamorous. Children not wanting to poo is a really, really big issue when children start potty training, because they feel it's not the right thing to do, because it's very different from just having a wee. It's very relaxed. And then when you have a poo, you have to obviously push, and they don't feel it's like a correct thing to do. So that's one of the biggest things. And I think when your child goes to nursery and then they potty train at home and you do two different methods, that is another really big pain point, because the children get very confused and very mixed messaging, mm-hmm. which we can't have. So they're really big. And obviously when to start, you know, you get pressured sometimes by parents, you know, in-laws, and you get pressured by nursery schools to start, and you know that your child's not ready, but you do it. And, you know, that's, you know, it's just a no. You have to do it when you know your child's ready. So there's quite a few, unfortunately, potty training.
That's why we have you here. And as I said, we've got a lot of messages coming in for you. Let's start with that, the readiness. What are some of the signs that your child might be ready for potty training? And typically, when might that be in terms of months or years?
So there's no set age. So we must all get that out of our heads. Every child develops at a different rate. So there's definitely no set age. But signs to look for that your child is ready is when they're stopping in their tracks, when they're doing a wee or a poo. When they do this, you know, start saying to them, even if they're not ready, are you doing a wee or are you doing a poo? Keep it simple, words that they can actually repeat. So are you doing a wee? Are you doing a poo? And then they go and hide, or they insist on having their nappy change when it's soiled. This is a sign that they're actually starting to feel uncomfortable, and they're realizing, I don't want to be in this anymore. So this is a great sign as well. And it also signifies, I can't even say the word today, that they're actually recognizing their bodily functions. So this is a really good time to think, right, okay, they're ticking some of these boxes. So then it's time to start the education, not to start the potty training. They need to be educated for a week or two first.
And what does that look like in practice?
So in practice, start reading them a potty training book, an app, which, you know, I developed an app in my potty training pack. So if you start educating them, visually showing them like flashcards, storybooks, apps, then they are going to understand what they actually have to do. Mm-hmm. Because just because they're showing signs they're ready, they still don't know what they've got to do. And they've been in their nappy for years, for 2 or 3 years. So we need to visually show them what to do first. So I can't stress enough how important it is when you start potty training to do the education. And it's fun for them. They see it as a fun experience. They all love to read a book. And if you show them visual pictures, they really do take that in more than commands. And I've been doing this now for, you know, I'm going to show my age here, like 25 years. And, you know, I know that this works. This is the method that actually works. And I potty train children hands-on a lot. So it really does work.
Amanda Jenner with us today. Mona's asking for your details. So with your permission, if you want to send me the word potty, I will happily send you Amanda's Instagram. There's some great links on there to resources on her website and more. So If you want to send that on to someone, message here saying I want to send it to my son. We've also got the text lines and the phone lines open too. This is Mara Chris, who's definitely getting ahead of the game because her baby is just 3 months old. So we're helping you out, preempting some problems and with what's happening going on. Here's Mara Chris.
Hello, good day. I'm Mara Chris. I'm a first-time mom of our lovely baby boy, Cesar Miguel. I wanted to ask what are the signs that my child is ready for potty training?
So
thank you.
Just what we've been talking there about those signs. So Mara Chris, I am impressed by that, I have to say. Because sometimes it is a case, as you said, about knowing where to go, the expert. So hopefully we've already answered that for you, Mara Chris. We've also had a message asking about how to get rid of the nappy at night. So this is from Elena. We've also had a message saying, anonymous, that our 8-year-old boy still isn't dry at night. He's year 4. 2 nights out of 7, he has an accident. They've got residential school trips coming up. They've got sleepovers. Can medication help?
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Royal Grammar School Guildford Dubai, sister school of RGS Guildford in the UK, educating the leaders of tomorrow since 1509.
Ahead of the Baby Expo next weekend, we've got one of their star guests, Amanda Jenner, on the line now. She's a potty training expert, an author, creator of the Potty Training Academy, and the absolutely award-winning, million-selling My Carry Potty. Amanda, thank you so much again for your time. Really, really appreciate it and can't wait to have you in Dubai next weekend. We've had a lot of messages for you, a lot of people asking for your details. If you want to send me the word potty, I will send you Amanda's Instagram and there's some great links and resources there on her website too. But nighttime dryness is something that is coming up on the text line again and again. We've had a message from Elena saying how to get rid of the nappy at night. Another message saying 3-year-old almost 99% trained in the day, but still wearing a nappy for night sleep. And then in a minute, we'll come on to an older child. I think that's a bit of a separate situation. But for potty training at night, nighttime dryness, it's a bit of a different way of approaching it in some ways, yeah, to my understanding. What do we need to know?
Yeah, it's very different nighttime because, obviously they're asleep. So it makes it a little bit difficult. But I just want to stop there on the 3-year-old that's nearly there in the day. Please don't start rushing to try and get your 3-year-old ready at night. You need to leave them at least a few months if they've just potty trained in the day, because they can regress still in the day. And we don't want to start throwing the nighttime training in on top of them just cracking the daytime. So leave it for at least 3 months after you've potty trained in the day. Really important. And the way to see whether they're ready to potty train at night is longer, drier periods. So they're waking up and their nappies are more drier in the morning. This is a good time to start thinking about starting nighttime training, but definitely make sure they're trained fully in the day first for a while. Now, nighttime training, you have to reduce liquids at least 1 hour before bedtime. And that also includes fruit, because we lots of children love fruit and it contains 80% of liquids. So we need to reduce that. And also the wheeze before bed. So leading up to bedtime, children do tend to, rush to the toilet. I'm sure all of you parents out there know that. They rush to the toilet and a second later they've done their wee and you're like, wow, how did they do that? But that's what they do. So they're not fully emptying their bladder. And this is something they will learn as they mature. But definitely you have to make sure that they're a few wees before bedtime. So come afternoon time, just make sure they're not rushing their wees and they're emptying their bladder. We can't tell whether they're emptying their bladder. It's not see-through, but we can tell whether they've actually sat there and done a proper couple of minutes relaxed wee. Nighttime training is very difficult. It's not easy. We've got the older one that we're going to come back to. But what I will say is that don't stress about it. The average age for nighttime training is around 5 to 6 years old. And I know that sounds alarming, but it's actually not. That's the average age here in the UK and actually mostly worldwide. So just don't stress about it. And you need to put a good night light on for your child, because lots of children are afraid of the dark. When they go to the toilet, a nice relaxed one, don't say to them, hurry up, it's bedtime. Let them have a nice chilled out wee. Mm-hmm. And then I would say, it's just going to be trial and error with nighttime training, and it can take months to do. And I know it's not a very, you know, upbeat thing to say, but this is the way it is. So don't panic. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with your child, but it does take a lot longer.
It's a developmental thing as well, I understand, kind of in the brain. It's almost like a completely separate system. So we can try our best, but it's going to happen when it's going to happen. Which leads me on to this message, Amanda, anonymous message, and you can of course leave your names off, that's no issue at all, saying, our 8-year-old is in year 4 and still isn't dry at night. I'd say 2 out of 7 nights he has an accident, and with residential school trips and sleepovers, it's really stressing him out. Can alarms or medication help? So what about the older children there, Amanda? I'm just going to say this. We had a residential trip recently, and the teacher said to me privately that they've had a number of parents with this, you know, 8 and 9-year-olds who still aren't dry at night. So no one really talks about it, but I can guarantee you are far from alone in this concern. So older children, so to speak, who aren't dry at night, Amanda, what does this parent need to know, and what could help?
Yeah, and Helen, I totally agree. Don't feel alone out there. I mean, you know, it's really important as parents and as a family community that we do talk about this, because, you know, I know parents, people say, oh, you know, why is your child doing this, and why is your child not hit that milestone? But listen, we go through all different things at all different rates at all different times. So please don't feel alone. And it's really good to talk. You can always contact me privately as well. But what I will say is, older children, it is very common as well. First of all, have you sought medical attention? So have you been to the doctor and told them what's going on? They can prescribe you with medication for this. So it's really important that you seek, some help if you're worried about it, or just at least talk to your doctor about it. Again, you know, is he holding on at school? So when we have these situations when children are older, and you actually delve into the whole thing and you start talking to them, oh no, I don't want to go, I don't wee at school, I don't go to the toilet at school, I'm too embarrassed, or they're holding on all day. And then what happens is they have a build up, and then at night they have lots of accidents. So do a bit of fact finding with him and find out if he's going, because they tend to not go as much at school, children. Is he constipated? So is his bowels opening every single day, or, you know, is he going to the toilet on a regular basis? Because also constipation can cause bedwetting as well. So these are some factors you've got to consider. And also, again, how many liquids in a day is he having? Is he, you know, drinking lots and lots and lots and drinking lots, you know, before he goes to bed? So these are factors that you really have to take into account. So, but please, if any of you are really worried about this, you can privately DM me on Instagram, or Helen will give you the details.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, don't worry about it. It's something that does go. So I just want to reassure you.
This parent also mentioned alarms. So I know you can get some gadgets for beds. How do you feel about those? And do they have a place?
I mean, you know, I never say to parents, don't, because it's your child. But the only thing with alarms is it's almost like a false thing where it's like waking them up, you know, to do it. We need to train the bladder so you actually start feeling the need to go, and it connects with the brain to get you up to go at night. I mean, he could be a really deep sleeper as well. So you could, you know, there is plenty of things that you can try. Lots of people do use the alarms or the watches, so that will wake him up. I mean, have you tried waking him up before you go to bed? Because it can be, you know, the bladder can be trained. So if you wake him up before you go to bed and make sure he has another wee, again, you can get into like a habit of actually going at certain times. You can train the bladder, but I definitely, first of all, would say, you know, go and see a doctor. They can prescribe something. And alarms, yes, they're great. It's up to you. But, you know, we want to get him sorted out. But, you know, it is stressful for a parent when this happens. Really stressful.
We've had a follow-up message about nighttime dryness saying, do we take out the nappy and live with the accidents, feeling the nappy might be hindering progress? That I remember this going, oh, we've had a few dry nights in a row. Is now the time we take the nappy away? And, you know, is that going to confuse and complicate things further? How do you know when to take away the nappy, Amanda?
Yeah, well, exactly like you just said there, Helen, when, you know, they've had a few dry nights, that's great. You know, let's try and do that for, get a dry night for about a week or two. Don't think, oh, I've had 2 dry nights, whisk the nappy off. So don't be too premature there. But what I would say is, Yes, because the thing is with potty training, which I want to say to all of you out there, like if you're going to get rid of something, like if you're going to start potty training in the day, you must get rid of the nappy. You must use potty training pants, which are cloth, or you must use normal pants, because the child will have mixed messaging. Mm-hmm. Again, the same at night. If they know they've got the nappy on at night, they're just going to go in the nappy because they're used to it. So we have to break the mold. And I know it's stressful, but you can get, you know, disposable mattress protectors, loose pajamas at the end of the bed. But definitely when they've been dry for at least a week, again, reduce the liquids, get them to lots of big wheeze leading up to bedtime, and then go for it. But you can use, you know, potty training pants at night, the cloth ones, the cotton ones. I'm just developing some nighttime ones as well, so children feel like grown up wearing them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely. We, you know, I think don't worry about nighttime potty training. It will come when they're ready. But all I will say is don't rush it. Okay. Don't try and rush it.
We're going to steal away Amanda Jenner for another 15 minutes. So it's your very last chance to get any questions in. She is something of a guru, it has to be said. Decades of experience. She's also an entrepreneur and author. We've also got messages coming in saying the easiest way is to look at their facial expressions, and if they're in the poo mood, take them straight to the toilet. That's how we did it for our daughter, and we start at 11 months and she doesn't poo at all in the nappies. Just had a message here saying, talking about nighttime dryness, but message here saying also worth getting blood sugar checked because there could be underlying diabetes. So Amanda's saying earlier, especially in older children, you know, getting to your family doctor and ruling out anything medical is really, really crucial. We had a really interesting message here from Steph saying, I've heard a few times that bribing children with a chocolate button for every successful attempt on the potty is a good approach. I'm wondering what Amanda thinks. I'm not totally against chocolate buttons, but is it necessary? Is it foolproof? I'm feeling a bit daunted by the idea of potty training. So what say you on bribery, Amanda Jenner?
Well, I love a bit of bribery because, you know, children don't naturally just say, oh, today I'm going to be so excited and I want to start potty training. So I'm all for bribery, and it doesn't have to be chocolate buttons. So my system is where you get poo and wee emojis and you cut them out and you wrap up some tiny little prizes, and they get a tiny little wee prize if they do a wee. So they understand the connection. Or they get a poo prize if they do a poo, which really encourages children.
But when do you stop? I mean, could you have a seven-year-old being like, I've done a wee, where's my prize? You know?
Yeah, you can stop. Don't worry. They don't want it. They want trainers or something by then. Okay. Honestly, it really works. This is what I do all the time, is a poo and wee prize. And they love it. And then I'm saying small prizes. I'm not saying, you know, go and spend a fortune. They can be very, very small things. Or I do a magic box where you can fill it up with little treats. They can be healthy treats. Doesn't have to be chocolate buttons, where they can put the hand in the magic box when they've done a wee or a poo. It absolutely works because they feel that they've done something really good. You're rewarding them instantly, so they understand that what they've just done is a good thing. So I'm totally for it, absolutely, and it does work. I've done it without, I've practiced it without, and I've done it with over 25 years, and 95% of children potty train more with something like a reward. You can use stickers, but what I find is with stickers, what I use stickers for is stickers for when they've tried. So, you know, where they go and sit on the potty and they've tried, because getting them to sit on the potty is the biggest battle. So I give them a sticker, well done for trying. But when they actually do and you physically see wee or poo in the potty, or if you want to go to the toilet with a trainer seat, that's fine too. I always give them a prize or a button.
Go forth, Steph, and bribe away. Let us know how it goes.
Yes.
We've just got 1 minute left, but this is a question saying, do you really need to stay at home for 5 days when you potty train? Lena's feeling a bit overwhelmed. No. Good. That's
a
short answer.
Absolutely not. Don't stay at home. Get out and about.
Take your carry potty with you. Amanda, thank you so, so much for your time. I've had loads of people asking for your details. You are here for Baby Expo next week. And I think it's going to be an absolutely brilliant event. So many incredible experts from all fields coming together.
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Royal Grammar School Guildford Dubai, sister school of RGS Guildford in the UK, educating the leaders of tomorrow since 1509.
Now, I don't know if I should admit this, but there are still some phrases around education and parenting that I'm completely baffled by, and I kind of nod along but don't really know what people are talking about. Pastoral care is one of them. I feel like it can kind of cover up a whole area of efforts and explains things that I'm not fully aware of. Why is it a good thing? What are the good things we should be asking for as parents when it comes to pastoral care? Don't worry. This is what we're talking about today, emotional well-being and the role of schools in that. And joining us now is education advisor at Cognita, Lizzie Varley, who plays a really key role in promoting the well-being, the inclusion, safeguarding across the region. Hi, Lizzie. Nice to see you.
Hi.
What is safeguarding? No, that's not true. I know what safeguarding is. What is pastoral care? How do you define it as a teacher and an educator? And what does it mean to you?
I think pastoral care is that holistic approach to a child and making sure, obviously, academics are so important within a school and we want our children to be successful academically. However, actually more importantly is their emotional resilience and their well-being. And pastoral care really, it's all about ensuring that children develop personally and socially and emotionally just as much as they do academically.
It's funny you should say that. I just had a conversation this morning with a school librarian, funnily enough, and we were talking about how, you know, a lot of schools, and rightfully so, put huge emphasis on the academics, but maybe don't communicate to children just how important it is to be emotionally healthy and it might be unpopular to say this, but likeable, to be nice, likeable kids, because, you know, those grades can get you through the door of, you know, university and later on through a workplace. But if you don't want to sit next to somebody, then you're not going to get the job. You know, this idea of being a good communicator, of dealing with conflict well, of, you know, knowing yourself, and yeah, having, being likable is so crucial, but something we don't really talk about. So we've had messages coming in for you, Lizzie. I'm going to hopefully help out some listeners today. We've had messages asking about what questions you should ask a school when you're touring about pastoral care, because I think a lot of parents will say, our school says they do a good job, but we don't really know what that looks like. But before we get to that, would you mind explaining some of the primary challenges, the most common things that come up with children when adapting to a new school, you know, new educational environments, whether that is going into FS or transitioning schools as well?
Yeah, I think especially thinking about our children as expats as well. I mean, most of our schools are made up of 70% to 97% of expat children. So I think sometimes we've got families coming here from all over the world, and cultural differences between home and the country in Dubai, like language barriers, different kind of educational experiences or expectations they've had in a previous country, unfamiliar social norms can be a challenge depending on when they're coming from. Just making new friends and fitting in, emotional, some children are more affected by kind of anxiety and attachment. So I think it's really important to know that children are so unique and they're so different, and I think experience transition in totally different ways. So it's just really important that schools have a real understanding of each individual child and what their needs are.
And a lot of that can come from communication of parents as well. You know, it's really unfair to drop your kids off and be like, okay, you know, it's 7:35. This child is your issue now for the next few hours, because presumably, you know, whether it's the well-being staff and school counsellors or indeed that teacher can only do what they can do with the information that they have. So if there has been, you know, issues at home, or there have been struggles with separation anxiety, or, you know, relocation, you know, being unsettled, how important is it that teachers are getting the full picture?
So important. I think relationships with parents and families are a key to successful kind of pastoral care as well. As we all know, as parents, we know our children the best, and we are the best people to inform teachers and schools on what's going on for that child. And I think it's all about partnership working. And I think where the best pastoral care is set up, there'll be clear kind of reporting guidelines, informal interactions with parents and with teachers. There's kind of the drop off by the door, you know, those conversations are so important, but also having that formal process that you might need to follow. So I think parents it's all about a collaboration, and a triangulation between the child, the parents and the teachers, and making sure that kind of child is kind of wrapped around with the best holistic kind of care that they can have.
Are there any specific programs, you know, strategies that Cognita in particular implements that, you know, maybe other schools could be learning from to support the emotional and social well-being of expat children, the students there?
I think with Cognita, we follow, you know, most kind of typical strategies that you would see in kind of outstanding schools for pastoral care. A few things that are a little bit different that have been trialling this year from the digital world. There's something called Microsoft Reflect. I'm not sure if you heard of it,
which is a new
tool.
I'm going to Google.
And it's like a wellbeing reflection kind of check-in tool. And it does two things. It kind of encourages children to use kind of different emotions and use the language of wellbeing and emotions. But also at the same time, it gives kind of teachers powerful data to see how individuals and classes are feeling over time. So those two things, that's been a brilliant kind of trial that we've been using this year.
It's super cute. Just looking at the little kind of fuzzy monsters on Microsoft Reflect. Lizzie Barley with us today from Cognita. Right, I've got three questions that come immediately to mind. So I'm going to give you a quick heads up on them. One's come in and you can always be anonymous saying, please help. Head of academics at my son's school is threatening the students to study harder. If they do not do well, he'll make them repeat the year. My son is now in counselling for anxiety. I went to school. They're denying all claims. A similar thing happened again yesterday. I feel like they're not taking my son's mental health seriously. What can I do? Great question. We don't know what school this is, nor do I need to know. We don't want to get into any specifics, but I guess that's a great question in terms of processes and how do you decide if a school is right for you? And James saying, will a school always say that they're strong in pastoral care? We're looking at secondary schools. What are some of the questions to ask at tours to understand how much of a priority it is?
I think a good question is, what is the student experience in your school? So kind of not giving the hint of you want a pastoral answer, but what is the general experience of students? So, and then in those answers, you're looking at things that are just that go beyond the academic. So are there wellbeing programs? What are the kind of the ECA provision? You know, the sports, performing arts, is the opportunities to be part of school councils? How is the experience develops the whole child? Things like, you can ask specific questions about mental health support, like specific services, counselling services, you know, what provision is there for that? In terms of heads of year and the pastoral teams that sit around the child, what does the tutor form tutor system look like? And I think one thing that I personally do as well is just, and I know this is a bit airy-fairy, but it's more the feel of a school and the culture. I think when you go there, listen to the conversations, look at how the children or the students interact with each other, how the teachers interact with the students. And I think kind of you really can get a real sense of the care and well-being within a school just from kind of the feel of how it is. And I think that's always a real key thing to listen to, is listen to your gut as well.
Great advice as an educator and a parent, I think. And a message here, anonymous message saying, please help. The head of academics at my son's school is threatening the students to study harder. And if they do not do well, he will make them repeat the year. My son's in counselling for anxiety now. I went to the school and they're denying all claims. A similar thing happened again yesterday. I feel like they're not taking my son's mental health seriously. So what can I do? I don't know what school this is, and as I said earlier, nor do I want to know. It's not about naming and shaming, because everyone has a very different experience a lot of the time. But in this specific situation, what are the processes that this parent should be going through in order to get to the bottom of this and, of course, support their son as well?
I think it sounds like obviously the issue has already been raised, and typically you kind of go down the route of speaking to the form tutor or class teacher first, and then if that hasn't been successful, you haven't got the answer that you want or you feel is right, then kind of escalating that to a middle leader, whether it's a head of year or head of subject, and then beyond that it would be, you know, taken on by a senior leadership team and ultimately the principal. And I think as a parent, you know when something is not okay with your child. I think it's really important to stick to your instincts. And if you genuinely feel that your child isn't okay and their well-being isn't okay, then of course you need to make sure that something is in place to support them. So I suppose it's taking up the right routes and along the right pathway. And, you know, sometimes schools don't fit with what you believe in terms of education. And it might be that school isn't going to be right for your child. So I think it's always worth having different conversations. People have different perspectives. The child has different perspectives to the teachers, listening to everyone and then kind of making that informed decision about, are you okay with the information you're getting back, or actually do you just ultimately just not fit with the culture of this school, and do you need to look elsewhere?
Can I ask though, does a teacher have the power to say, I'm going to make you repeat the year? Surely that's not something an individual teacher can say and demand. That seems really rash.
No, and I don't think typically, no, teachers would absolutely not say that. And I think typically we don't see, I mean, I think previously, maybe years ago, we saw a lot of children repeating the year. There's not much evidence to suggest that that actually makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, in very rare circumstances, yes, it might be better for the child, but that would be after a really long consideration, probably, you know, two terms of conversation involving the parents, and normally related to an inclusion, from an inclusion perspective. But in general, no, that is not something that you would expect, definitely not a class teacher to say off the cuff.
Thank you. Just needed to hear it from you, Lizzie. Lizzie Barley, really appreciate your time as ever. Thank you so much for being with us today, Pastoral Care, and keeping this conversation going with Cognita. Lizzie Barley speaking to us.
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Royal Grammar School Guildford Dubai, sister school of RGS Guildford in the UK, educating the leaders of tomorrow since 1509.
Talking pastoral care and what schools can and should do to support our children's emotional well-being. Stephen Howard is with us today, the head of Year 4 at Horizon English School. Looking very smart indeed. How are you, Mr. Howard?
I'm good, thank you for having me.
My absolute pleasure. I think this is quite an emotive topic for a lot of parents, because we all have different priorities about what we want from our children's education. And to some, and I'm certainly no judgment on any people on the spectrum, is for some it is, you know, we are paying for a service of, and I want these the results academically. For others, it is, you know, if I have a child who hates going to school, that's going to make their life miserable and my life miserable. So the happiness is the priority.
Yes.
Can I ask you then, what are some of the common challenges that do come up at school? You know, what are kids maybe struggling with? I'm not just talking about Horizon, you know, in particular, but you're well connected with schools around the UAE. What do you think children in the UAE in 2024 are having a bit of a tough time with?
I think, you know, the transient nature of Dubai, you know, means that we've got a lot of children coming in at different points. It's not like the UK, for example, where children are coming in reception and they're staying in those schools for their entire educational career. We've got a lot of...
You live in this certain area, yes. So you go to this school, you know, all the way through, and you've got a natural transition because then you're going to go to the school, you know, in the next town over. It's not the case.
No, I think, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges here is that, you know, I am head of Year 4. We've had, I'd say, around 10 new students this year, and all coming from different curriculums, different backgrounds, speaking different languages. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges is getting used to that, especially the new curriculum, I think is a big one that we see a lot of. That can be a really big change in a child's educational career. And I think, like Lizzie said earlier, that making sure that there are systems in place to make sure that those children feel comfortable and those teachers are building strong relationships from day one.
Mm-hmm.
I think helps to break down some of those barriers that those children face.
And presumably a lot of parental concerns around that as well, saying, you know, we're here ultimately most likely for a job and to save money and to have a better life. But that might mean putting a child in midterm, and there could be established friendship groups and our own anxieties about starting a new school.
Yes.
I had that. I was terrified about, you know, about my daughter starting school, because I remember having a bit of a tough time myself when I was little. And then those anxieties get passed down to the kids as well.
Yeah, I think it's important. Like we have buddy systems in place. So as soon as a new child will join, we'll always put them in a buddy with a long-standing, you know, child who's been at that school for a long time. Small things like going to pee and knowing where the sports hall is and knowing where the library is. I think just having that buddy system in place makes them feel so comfortable from day one. And I think, you know, we choose our buddies very carefully, children who are welcoming and children who've been in Dubai for a long time as well, because what I love about teaching in Dubai is that, you know, my classroom has 11 different nationalities, you know, that's in a class of 25 kids. There are so many children who are so open to different cultures and different languages. I think it's a lot easier in Dubai to come into a classroom from a different culture because you've got children who are so used to it. I mean, obviously, depending on the school you go to and the makeup of those schools.
But, no, I completely
agree. You know, at Horizon,
agree.
I think that's a, yeah.
I think about this a lot. And again, if anyone's moving back to a home country, specifically the UK, I'm sorry for what you're about to hear. But I know I chat to my best friend, Rachel, and she's got kids kind of similar age to mine.
Yeah.
And it's... it's a smaller world. You know, her daughter Dylan, I'm like, she's surrounded by kids that look like her, that live within a, probably a 3-mile radius of the school. The kids are probably eating all the same thing for their lunchboxes. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Lunchables.
Yeah. It's all about the Stackables and the Lunchables and your Dairylea dippers and things. My friend worked in the Dairylea dipper factory in Tyne and Wear and never ate one after hearing the stories. But, you know, that's... And there's a safety and the security in that. And I understand that sense of belonging and how important that is. And I had that growing up. I've got friends, you know, from literally, you know, 35, 40 years ago. But then I look at the opportunities that being in this, you know, diverse and multicultural environment have on my children, which is they've got friends, as you said, from like, you know, countless different nationalities and mixes of nationalities and, you know, foods and, you know, going, you know, having, I don't know, all the food from all over the world and all the languages that they're hearing. And I just think, gosh, you know, what an advantage that is for our kids. And as you say, the downside is the transient nature that, you know, someone might be gone in a couple of weeks if a job changes or, you know,
definitely
an opportunity.
I think one of the things that really benefits the children as well is, you know, remembering that a lot of those teachers are expat teachers as well. So, you know, they've been through similar processes and, you know, we at the moment are, you know, looking at our, you know, year five classes, for example, and we do have children leaving who are moving home countries or they're moving to different countries because of the job that their parents have. And that maybe wouldn't be the same, like you said. You know, I remember the school that I used to teach at in Birmingham. Those parents are working within a 10-mile radius of the school. The kids are living within a 3-mile radius of the school. It's not the same. And I think that can be, it can have a really big impact, you know, that if a child has a small amount of friends in a class, for example, and two of them leave, that can have a really big impact. So making sure that you've got those, you know, pastoral care systems in place to make sure that, you know, you are identifying those needs. I know Lizzie mentioned Microsoft Reflect. We use that at Horizon to, you know, identify how a child is feeling and try and intervene or try and identify how they're feeling before we have to intervene. And I think just having that foresight and knowing how a child could react is almost better than being reactive to what's happened
in the moment. It's funny you mentioned about the class changing up, because different schools do it in different ways.
Yep.
So it might be, you know, 2 years, then a change, 2 years and a change, 1 year, it changes every year. So Horizon English is every 2 years.
It's completely dependent on what's best for the children.
Interesting.
And I think there are elements there, you know, there are schools who change every 2 years. There are also schools that may never change. Mm-hmm. And I think, for us, we look at the cohort, we'll look at the class makeup, and we'll look at everything from the academic level, the emotional, I suppose, stability of that class as well.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because COVID was really disruptive for a lot of schools, obviously. Yes. So it might be a case of we would have normally changed the class, but they haven't actually seen each other for quite a few months, they're going to stick together for another year. Or this teacher left, but now we'll have a bit more stability with someone for another year. How does it work then? Do kids get to kind of choose? You're saying there you're working out the classes.
Yeah, so if for example, you know, when I was in... So 2 years ago, we had we split year four to go to year five. I think we split two classes. We will always give the children an option to give us a group of children that they would like to move with, so that that transition is easy.
Softer.
Yeah, and I think the only reason we would change classes or split classes is if it is going to benefit those children. You know, if those children are making progress, if they have got friends in the class, unless there is a real need to split those children, we won't. You know, for example, year four, we have six classes and there might be five classes in year five. You know,
it can come down to maths.
Exactly. Yeah, sometimes it's the maths. So, we try not to cause too much disruption if we don't need to.
Do you get parents who are like, Mr. Howard, she put so-and-so on her list and she's not with her?
We would do
like a 3D jigsaw puzzle that you're trying to work out the whole time. Yeah.
And like Lizzie mentioned earlier, parents have different expectations. We've got, you know, I'm having conversations with parents at the moment where some parents want to keep their children together.
And some might be, I never want them to be with this child ever again.
And you'd be surprised. It's not normally to do with academics. It's exactly what we're talking about now, which is pastoral side of, you know, the friendships, the emotional stability. And it might be that they feel like there's someone in that class who, you know, doesn't necessarily... isn't the most positive influence on their child and thinks that then that will affect their academics. And
I'm always a big fan for mixing up classes, to be honest, because...
Is this you asking to...
Yeah, if you could mix them all up, that'd be great. No, because I just think the more the more kids your child knows in a school, the better. And there's opportunities to, you know, meet children through ECAs. You know, you've got out school activities where they might connect with kids that aren't in their class, but they might go to the same school. I just feel like we were just talking about likability earlier with Lizzie, but there was a really interesting study recently which was talking about popularity of kids. And it's not even in a high school kid, it's not even the best looking, the most academic, the sportiest kids who are the most quote unquote popular or likable. It's the ones who are making the eye contact, saying, oh, you know, morning, Alia, or I'll see you in choir later, or, you know, and having that range of different friendship groups.
I think that's really important. You know, I think that's something we pride ourselves on at Horizon specifically, you know, making sure that child in year six is leaving as a well-rounded individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have four key learning skills, and, you know, one of those is communication. Our year three team, for example, have been doing an action research project where they've been focusing on communication. In your year four, we've been focusing on collaboration. So, you know, within those schools, there are things happening to make sure that those life skills are taught. We're teaching them how to communicate, eye contact, for example, but how they speak to each other, how they actively listen and respond to each other, how they collaborate with each other in pairs, in groups. And I think that's really important to teach.
Just a minute left now with Stephen Howard, the year four head at Horizon English School, talking there about having 11 different nationalities in one classroom. So I wanted to ask then, when you have got, you know, teachers coming over from, we're talking there about you being in Intercity Birmingham, where you know, might have all English speakers. Do you do any, I guess, cultural sensitivity training for teachers? You know, make sure that everyone is ready for this kind of amazing, such a cliche, melting pot.
Yeah, I think you have to. I think obviously when we come over, or when any teachers come over, you know, at Horizon we have an induction program for all of our teachers, and that's included in that. You know, we're big in our inclusive environments in, you know, at Horizon, and, you know, at different points in the year when there's things going on in different cultures, we're not shying away from, I wouldn't say we're not celebrating them, but we're open to those discussions around children sharing, you know, the experiences they're going through. And I think, you know, through teachers being, I suppose, guided on how to question and how to celebrate that, you know, you are, I suppose, celebrating that melting pot as opposed to, you know, only focusing on kind of what's going on in this country.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because especially when you have like English in the school name, but that's so far from it when you've got, you know, obviously Eden, Diwali, and you've got, you know, Arabic departments there. Yeah. And every child wants to be proud of their heritage and also learn from each other, you know, to come home and say, oh, I just learned, you know, did you know that in this country? I think kids love this idea of learning from each other.
Definitely. And I think that's something that's really important, you know. Like I said, we've got 11 different nationalities. Some of those are dual nationalities as well. So there's probably more like 14, 15. Gosh. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is, if a child is coming in the morning going, oh, you know, this is what we did last night and this is why we did it, the last thing you want to do is shut that down. Yeah. So I think celebrating that is really important in the right way, respectfully, in the country that you're living in.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Howard, for coming in.
No,
I know you guys have a long day, so I extended it a little bit by asking you to come into the studio.
No, it was a
today.
Pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. And we talk education every single Thursday afternoon. Right, get yourself home. I'm sure you've got some marking to do.
Thank you.
It is Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer. That was Eye on Education. I'm Helen Farmer, and you can catch us live on Dubai Eye 103.8 every single Thursday afternoon.